This episode of Coffee House Shots is sponsored by Alliance Witten Investment Trust. From the OPEC oil crisis of the 1970s, the financial crash in 2008, to the COVID epidemic and Liz Truss's doomed premiership, there has been no shortage of economic crises over the last 58 years. And yet, throughout that time, every single year, without fail, we've paid out an increased dividend to our shareholders. In fact, Alliance Witten's history dates all the way back to 1888. And today, we manage around £5 billion in assets. If you're looking for a less stressful way to invest in stocks and shares, learn more about Alliance Witten and find your comfort zone.
Hello, and welcome to a special live edition of Coffee House Shots. And it's a very special edition too, because this is going to be the last Coffee House Shots Live of Kate Andrews for a while, because she's about... Yes, so now you can sound very sad. Because, though, she is moving to America for The Spectator to be the new Deputy Spec US Editor. So your New York dream is soon to happen.
It is. Please come visit.
Okay, great. We'll do what an American pay for everyone to get there. And so welcome to Kate. And then we also have Michael Gove, The Spectator's editor. And two special guests. We're delighted to have Jonathan Ashworth, CEO of Labour Together. Yeah. And we're particularly thrilled because you actually have done one of these before and you still decided to come back. And then finally, Robert Jenrick, Shadow Justice Secretary. So the title is fairly broad for today's discussion, and we're going to do some questions up here and then some audience questions. But the idea is the year ahead. Now, where to start? I suppose often we try and test the temperature in the room. So just to get a sense of where we are, nearly 6 months into the Labour government, who thinks the government is doing well? Okay. I'm looking. Who thinks the Tory party and the new leader of the opposition, or newish leader, Kemi Badenoch, is doing well? Okay. Okay, I see a couple of hands. Not many. And who thinks that Nigel Farage, the leader of the Reform Party, is doing well? Okay, so that so far is the biggest support base. Now, we're speaking tonight just as Keir Starmer heads to Washington for his first meeting with Donald Trump. Michael, given you are the only person on this panel, because who's actually met and interviewed Donald Trump before, can you give us a sense of what Keir Starmer has awaiting him?
Donald Trump is unlike any other human being on the planet. It's almost as though he is another species. It's almost as though he's evolved, or perhaps regressed, to a level of alpha primate authority, which means, as Emmanuel Macron found out earlier this week, that when you shake his hand, you find that your arm may be wrenched out of its socket. Because Donald Trump wants to demonstrate that he is not just the most powerful man in the world, but someone who has to assert that power in every interaction. So for our Prime Minister, a man of naturally, how can one best put this, stoical demeanor, it will be a challenge. On the upside, Donald Trump likes to charm people. As I mentioned to Jonathan earlier, when I went in to interview him with a German colleague, Kai Diekmann. Donald Trump turned to us, he'd just been elected president, but not yet inaugurated. He looked at my German colleague and me, and he said, "Who are these two good-looking guys?" It's the only time that phrase has ever been attached to my name. So he wants to win you over, but it's also on his terms. And I discovered that when we were interviewing him, each question was merely a prelude to him saying what he wanted to say in a stream of consciousness which took in his golf courses, how beautiful Mar-a-Lago was, and also how much he hated the Germans.
So, how did the German journalist take this?
Yes, yeah, quite. That was the reason why a German journalist was there, so he could get the message direct. I think that for our Prime Minister, it will be an endurance trial, and not that he would ever take any advice from me, but I think the best thing to do would be to smile, allow the President to do most of the talking, take every compliment you can, and then hopefully leave and allow the heavy lifting thereafter to be done by Peter Mandelson. because Peter Mandelson has shown, he has demonstrated throughout his political career, that he has the ability to assume whatever position is required on behalf of Her Majesty.
Now, Jonathan, of course, you are close to number 10. You've worked for Keir Starmer when you were serving as an MP. What do you think his approach is going to be on this trip? And do you think, I mean, there's been a lot in advance of Donald Trump starting about how difficult the relationship was going to be between Labour and the White House. There was criticism of Mandelson from some of Trump's advisers. I think one called him an absolute moron. But how do you think it's going?
Well, I mean, first of all, can I start by saying how delighted I am to be back here at The Spectator. When I saw the two hands go up for the people who thought the Labour government was doing well, I do feel like Daniel in the lion's den. So I'm looking forward to the conversations. But frankly, when you're a shadow Secretary of State and you lose your seat in a general election and all your colleagues form a government, frankly, you're grateful for any invitation. It's rather given me something to do tonight by being here. Look, I think there's a serious point, which is, first of all, it is a good thing. It's obviously a good thing for Keir Starmer personally, but I think it's a good thing for the country that the UK Prime Minister has got this audience with President Trump this week, and he's got this audience way ahead of other Europeans. I know Macron was there earlier in the week, but nonetheless ahead of a lot of the other European leaders. And I think everybody who is a patriot, everyone who believes in this country, and I, as everyone in this room will do, I have no doubt, will want that trip to succeed. Our relationship with the United States is what is our most important bilateral relationship internationally, and we have to build on it and we have to strengthen it. There are bonds between the United Kingdom and the United States which go back over many, many years, and we are rightly proud of that. And obviously, Keir Starmer has a different set of political values to Donald Trump. Obviously, no one is trying to pretend that they are on the same part of the political spectrum. I mean, it'd be ludicrous to suggest that. But nonetheless, the bonds are more enduring, and their differences in political outlook, I think, can withstand that. I think the second thing which is interesting is that Keir Starmer's government this week has said that we should be spending more on defence and has taken a very tough decision to cut international aid in order to fund that expansion in defence expenditure. That is difficult for a Labour government. People who join the Labour Party generally join the Labour Party because they're motivated by issues of poverty, both domestically and internationally, and motivated by issues around public services. So do not underestimate what a big move it is for a Labour government to take a very tough decision on international aid. And it will go. I don't think there actually has to be a vote in Parliament as it happens, but even if there was a vote in Parliament, these Labour MPs would support that, and that is because we have a set of Labour MPs who support their Prime Minister. And in recent years, we've slightly got used to sort of chaos in Parliament, rebellions and governments not knowing whether they're going to get their programme through, even Prime Ministers being forced out and so on. There is a stability in Parliament now because of the 400 Labour MPs who are loyal to Keir Starmer. So as it happens, I don't think there has to be a vote on this unless Katie tells me otherwise. But nonetheless, that decision will have the support of the Parliamentary Labour Party. Look, we'll see what happens on Thursday or Friday when we get the inevitable press conference of these two personalities stood side by side. There'll be lots of interpretation of their body language. There'll be lots of, the press will be looking for a snub. I remember back in the day when I worked for Gordon Brown, many, many years ago when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, on one of these trips, I think President Obama gifted him a set of Hollywood movies, and I think it turned out that I can't remember if they were video cassettes or if they were CDs, but whatever it was, it turned out that what was gifted to us would not work on the UK machines, right? And that was written up as a huge snub, as if the lobby loved it. They wrote lots of articles about how this was a devastating indictment of the relationship between President Obama and the Prime Minister. And actually what probably happened is some sort of middle-ranking staffer in the White House was probably sent out to buy these and didn't realise that they couldn't be played on UK machines. But there's no doubt something like that will happen again, and it'll be written up as if it's incredibly significant when it won't be. What is significant is that Keir Starmer is there. He seems to have built a reasonable rapport on President Trump. They seem to have a good working relationship. And hopefully they can find a way through which brings peace to Ukraine, but does so in such a way that doesn't completely sell them out and secures the ongoing future security of Europe.
First, Kate, given you've had your eyes and ears on America, and we do have Trump's, you know, Trump 2.0, how do you think it is going, and how is it different to the first Trump term so far? And obviously we've seen Doge, we've seen various forms of chaos, talks of potential rifts, denials, but what are your main takeaways so far?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that he has a more specific sense of what he wants to do, and he knows how to do it. He knows what parts of the state were standing in his way, and he is knocking them down with bulldozers and an actual chainsaw gifted from Javier Milei, the Argentine president, to Elon Musk at CPAC. And he knows exactly what he wants, and he's going to try to get it this time. When it comes to Britain's relationship with the U.S. and how this is going to develop, and indeed Ukraine's relationship, countries that matter very much right now, I was thinking going into my last coffee house shots in the UK, I wanted to say something bold. I've come up with two thoughts that I think might age really, really badly in the next 24
Please.
Hours, and I'm going to go for them. The first is that what we learned from Donald Trump 1.0 is that he loves a show. He loves theater. He loves to perform. So what's happening over here and the language he's using and the way that he's rallying everybody up has very little to do with what's actually happening in the real world, what his officials are doing, what's being processed. And this is a very good example this week. That last week, Donald Trump was calling President Zelensky a dictator, and this week, it's very likely that Zelensky is going to be shaking his hand in front of cameras and in front of the video screens. And I think that gives us some reason to be optimistic. And here's where this opinion may just completely blow up. It gives us some reason to be optimistic that for all of Trump's ugly and petty banter, and he promised us vengeance and he's giving it, it turns out, to Ukraine, that there's reason to think that there's much more happening behind the scenes. And then another quite odd opinion, I think Keir Starmer's pulled a blinder when it comes to America. I also noticed the two hands that went up in the audience in terms of domestic policy, and I think you're completely right. But Keir Starmer seems to be the only European leader that Donald Trump has anything nice to say about. He thinks they're both big winners. He thinks that they both did very well in the election, and he likes that. And Starmer's decision to keep the UK's head down, to not talk tough on tariffs the way that the EU has been doing, to basically say nothing, to recognize that Donald Trump has a soft spot for the UK and he particularly loves Scotland, is quite a smart way to play this. And I think what Donald Trump did to Emmanuel Macron was nothing short of humiliating, putting him at the side of the desk and making him feel small. I suspect we're going to see something different when the Prime Minister properly meets with the President in Washington. I think it's going to be a pretty friendly conversation. Do I think Starmer is going to be able to convince Donald Trump to change his rhetoric on Ukraine? No, but I don't think anybody convinces Donald Trump, except for apparently Fox and Friends, what he should say about any particular topic. But I do think the Prime Minister has played this fairly well so far, and it might be possible going into the weekend that the write-ups are pretty good because they've got on. They've been friendly. And I think Keir Starmer made a great decision to speak to Donald Trump before the election, to have that dinner, to get on a good page. I think this is one of the few areas where you can give the Prime Minister some credit.
And on that point, I mean, let's just go back to the audience for a minute. So who here, raise your hand if you think that Donald Trump should be trusted and could be a good thing for Ukraine? Okay, not loads. And who thinks Donald Trump shouldn't be trusted on Ukraine? Okay, a bit more. Now, Robert, Cammie Badenoch this week gave a speech on the need for realism. There was also recently a Spectator cover on the need for realism, I think in advance of the speech.
Yes, but that Spectator cover story was in fact a rip-off of a column that Robert actually wrote in the Daily Telegraph a couple of weeks beforehand.
Okay, we're going full circle. Robert, do you think the rules have now changed in terms of how we are going to have to approach? Do you think we can no longer rely on America in the way we have for decades?
Well, firstly, good evening, and thank you, Katie, for and Michael and Kate for the invitation, and good luck in your new job in the United States with The Times. It's not the first time that Michael has joined an organisation everyone started to vote leave. I slightly take issue with this idea that the world has fundamentally changed. I tend to think what's happened is that the rubber has hit the road, but that this has been a long time coming, and that you can place Donald Trump in a long historical line of American presidents, you know, it was, which you can go back a very long way, but even in more recent times, it was Obama who said that the United States had to pivot to Asia. There's a cross-party consensus in Washington that the challenge of our generation is the rise of China. What's really happened is that Donald Trump has kind of called time, and the threats that have been made by successive presidents have now reached the point where Europe just has to step up and do what it hasn't done for the whole of our lifetimes. And in that sense, and I'll come to Donald Trump's language in a moment, but in that sense, I think it's a very legitimate point of view. You know, Europe is militarily weak. European leaders for decades have been weak and feckless, have underinvested in defense, have pursued a naive energy policy, have cozied up to other countries who mean us ill and not taken, you know, more realistic attitudes. And that has to come to an end now. You've got a president who's finally saying, enough is enough. Europe has to take responsibility or a higher degree of responsibility for its own defense. And I think that's both been a long time coming and actually a legitimate point of view. Now, I don't agree with the language that he said. I think the fact that he's used Vladimir Putin's talking points in recent weeks has been very harmful. It's offensive, isn't it? President Zelensky is not a dictator. He's an incredibly brave man. He stayed in Kyiv when people were out to kill him, when many people would have fled. And so what we have to do, and I think Keir Starmer has tried to do this, I think Cammie Badenoch tried to do this, is to strike that balance where we call out the things that we think Trump is getting wrong, but we're also understanding of the American position, which I think in many respects is a perfectly legitimate one. And we have to step up now as a continent and invest significantly more in our defense. And in that sense, I welcome what was said by the Prime Minister yesterday. I think it's pretty small beer, to be honest. I mean, 0.2% extra on defense in 2027 is nothing. Absolutely nothing. The Ministry of Defense is massively overspent on its existing budget. I suspect no one even knows what that's going to buy, if anything. It probably doesn't even provide enough money to restock the munitions that we've given to Ukraine and now need to purchase again. I think we're going to have to go very significantly further than that, and we're going to have to think of credible ways in which to fund that. As Kemi said, welfare reform is an obvious avenue. I'm pleased that Keir Starmer has said that he's going to use some of the international aid budget to fund this. There were lots of Labour politicians, incidentally, in the summer when I said that, who described me as populist, who said this was an outrageous position. It's just commonsensical, isn't it? You've got to ultimately do what is in the best interest of the country, and in a world of hard choices, it's better to be spending our money on hard power than on soft power in a moment like this. And so I think it's the right decision.
Hey, on that funding question, if we go with the idea that it's going to have to go much more above 2.5, obviously Keir Starmer setting out a way it could go up potentially to 3% in the future, do you think welfare reform is going to be what might find the money, or are we actually going to have some pretty hard conversations about how we will fund the levels of defense spending needed in this current setup?
Well, it turns out all these conversations are hard, and it turns out politicians don't really want to cut anywhere or anything. We can talk, and The Spectator has. My colleague Michael Simmons a couple weeks ago did a cover about The Spectator's Doge. He's actually created a database you can use for free on The Spectator's website to find all the government ways. But
and the name of that project, Kate?
The Spectator's Project for...
Against frivolous
funding. And you can take up the abbreviation on your own.
Project Spef.
These are incredibly important points that nobody in government, and I'm not just going to say this one, previous ones as well, wanted to take up. Look, this is where I think you can pretty much criticize every major political party. Certainly Labour, certainly Tories, certainly Reform when it comes to the conversation that we're having now. It is egregious that the UK is not in a position where if it needs to find 15, 20, 25 billion pounds for an emergency, a shift in global power, an emphasis on Europe stepping up to defend itself, the core aspect of any state. If you believe in nations, if you believe in borders, if you believe in the nation state, you believe in a strong defense. The fact that the UK has no idea where, how it can find that money in a serious and long-term way is an absolute disgrace. And it is because no major political party wants to talk about what's really tough. We can talk about finding welfare savings. There are savings to be found. But you have to talk about the health service. You have to talk about the state pension. You have to talk about things that no politician dare say out loud if you really want to talk about the core functions of the state. And I think that this is a challenge to Labour, to the Tories, to every major party. And it perhaps is the biggest challenge to Reform. They're not on the stage, so slightly unfair. They can't represent themselves. But for all the traction they're getting, their economic side of their manifesto, it's fantasy at the moment. You can't just keep spending and then go, oh, actually, there's an emergency. Where are we going to find the money? There is no money at the moment. So you either have to make the case to increase taxes, you have to make the case to cut other spending, or you have to grow the economy. Isn't that our favorite phrase these days from politicians, to grow the economy? Seeing as they haven't been able to do that in any meaningful way, let's actually talk seriously about budgets and where the money should go.
Well, I think there is an appetite in the Labour government for a serious conversation about some of these matters, not least because we've got no option, because President Trump's tariff regime is going to have an impact on us, regardless of whether they put tariffs on UK goods. I mean, essentially, what he is doing is that he is going to drive inflation in his economy, in my view, because he's going to do deficit expansion. Tariffs is going to mean higher prices for his own consumers. And the third element of his tariff plan is to drive demand in the US. I think it's inevitable that the Fed are going to respond with interest rate rises in the US. That's going to strengthen the dollar against sterling and the euro, and it's going to have an impact on global growth. And we are an economy which is open to trade. It's going to impact us here. It's going to impact our gilt yields. It's going to impact our fiscal position. So we're going to have to think seriously about this, and we're going to have to think seriously about what that means for the balance of tax and spend. However, I do think this Labour government can go into some territory which the previous Conservative government, albeit rhetorically, wanted to get to but never could, which is on welfare reform and regulatory reform, actually. You know, if we continue with the current projections on disability spend, we're going to be hitting 100 billion by 2029. For adults, it'll be 75 billion. We'll be spending more on disability than we spend on defence, pretty much, right, in this country, on disability benefits. 3.5 million people are on the sickness-related element of disability benefits, and it's because there are problems with the structure now of universal credit, which is disincentivising people from trying to find work. That's the first thing. The second thing is, because it's an overhang from the pandemic, once you're on disability benefit, we used to be reassessing 40,000 people a month. That's gone down to about 2,000 since the pandemic. So it's no wonder the numbers on disability benefit have stayed at these huge, huge numbers. And actually, all the surveys suggest there's lots of people within that group who want to move into work if they were given the right help and the right support. I actually think that this Labour government is prepared to make, which will be some tough decisions on welfare reform, in the way in which the previous Conservative government did say it wanted to do rhetorically, but never actually got there. And on regulation, there's a very interesting and sort of government waste and quangos and all of that now. It's very interesting that if you talk to people in government, how interested they are becoming in this agenda, because they have found, once they've moved into government, that there is capital we want to put to work in this country in infrastructure projects, but we cannot spend it, we cannot get cranes in the sky and spades in the ground because of these vast swathes of costly, time-consuming bureaucracy. So much can go to court, so much can be JR'd all the time in court. This government is up for cutting away at some of this bureaucracy, which is holding back our ability to put capital to productive work in this country. So look, that's unusual, perhaps, from what people expect from a Labour government, but I think they're up for it. And as I said in my first answer, they've also got 400 Labour MPs who are prepared to push it through Parliament as well.
Jonathan just talked there, Michael, about some of the things this Labour government says it's going to do. It's going to stop various malign forces. Do you think there's been a shift in tone coming from Number 10 and this Labour government in recent months?
Yes, I do. I mean, well, the first thing is, I mean, I wish Jonathan's colleagues well in that endeavour. I mean, because it will be tough. There was a former Spectator editor who went on to become Chancellor of the Exchequer, Nigel Lawson. So there's hope for me yet. who was once asked, how do you cope with the relentless pressure from Tory MPs for tax cuts? He said, if only the relentless pressure that I get from Tory MPs is for public spending increases. Mm-hmm. I found that, and I know that Robert will have done. We were both at different times Secretary of State and broadly the same department. And again, without naming names, most of the time we would have colleagues coming to us explaining A, why there shouldn't be new houses in their constituency, and then B, why we should give them 10, 15 or 20 million pounds for a wonderful, beautiful, beautiful project in their constituency. And of course we did our very best to do the latter, but not the former. Anyway, the reason I mention that is that when you do make a big public expenditure cut, then you face a backlash. And when I was Education Secretary right at the very beginning of the coalition government, cancelled the Labour government's Building Schools for the Future programme. That didn't mean that we weren't going to have any school rebuilding, but we thought that this programme was unjustifiably profligate. Anyway, that meant that we had to pause school rebuilding in a variety of areas. One of them was a Conservative area, and the local Conservative MP, rather than saying, well done, Govey, at last public expenditure is under control. We've seen the way that Greece has gone, and you're doing the right thing by cutting here. Three cheers, said, Michael, I'm afraid that my constituents are aghast at this. I'm going to be leading a march on Downing Street to demand your resignation. So, I do wish them well, but one thing that I have noticed, in fact, two things that I have noticed, is that this Prime Minister, whatever else one might think of him, learns on the job. And I think it is the case that he has appreciated, as Jonathan indicates, that if he's going to achieve the things he wants to in terms of growth, then some of the agencies, organisations, quangos and bureaucracy that stand in the way of infrastructure being delivered will have to be tackled. So I think he was genuinely both aghast and angry that £110 million had to be spent on a bat tunnel to allow HS2 to proceed. I think he'll come up against some challenges, because it is the case that the reason why we have these rules and regulations is because in the UK we have more people who are members of wildlife and conservancy organisations per capita than any other country in the world. And it's also the case that there are people in Keir Starmer's government, friends of his, who are very attached to the whole structure of judicial review and the courts restraining the executive. So it will be tough, but I think that he does recognise, and this is the second thing, unless the government is seen to deliver change, then that's it. So people were exasperated with us as Conservatives, especially me. not Robert, me. Exasperated, kicked us out. They want change. And if Labour merely occupy office and don't do anything terribly wrong, that won't be enough. And a phrase has been adopted by some people around Keir Starmer called insurgent government. And what that means, I think, is a desire to show to people that having voted for change, it will be delivered, and it will be delivered in areas that matter. So that's both infrastructure, the economy, but also crime and migration as well. And again, many of the people who were Jonathan's colleagues before might be uncomfortable with that, but I suspect the realization is dawning on those who may have been uncomfortable initially that their voters, or a significant chunk of their voters, if they don't see that change, won't be returning them to Westminster at the next general election. And the final thing I would say is that the person, I think, more than anyone who's been responsible for that is the Prime Minister's new, relatively new Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. And he was the guy who, along with Jonathan, delivered Labour's landslide election victory. So even dyed-in-the-wool Tories like me have to acknowledge that he has, I think, correctly identified the single most important challenge for Labour. And even though the first 6 or 7 months of Labour government were wasted, I think, nevertheless, they've woken up and they have smelt what defeat might be like and are reacting appropriately.
Robert.
Well, I don't really know what Keir Starmer stands for and who is running this country right now. It feels to me if the most powerful person in Britain today probably is Morgan McSweeney. I don't think that Keir Starmer believes in cutting the international aid budget to spend it on defence. I think the last sort of remnant of Keir Starmer is the Chagos deal, which speaks more to his agenda than anything that we're seeing latterly. But I agree with Michael that it sounds like Morgan McSweeney is starting to you know, lead the way. But I think the government doesn't have any kind of plan. I mean, I can't think of a government in my lifetime that has come into office with so little agenda. You know, Michael, when you became Education Secretary in 2010, you say, you know, you might have made a blunder or were criticised for stopping that Building Schools for the Future programme. Mm. But you walked in through the door with a bill, didn't you, for free schools?
Yeah.
With an agenda. Mm. You'd spent years thinking about it. I cannot think of a single government department where that's the case. I mean, I was in the Home Office, and you have probably the most equipped person to be Home Secretary in Yvette Cooper. She was Shadow Home Secretary. She chaired the Home Affairs Select Committee. Then she returned as Shadow Home Secretary. She spent 10, 15 years auditioning for this job. I can't really name anything that she's done in the first 6 or 9 months in office. And I agree with you, Michael, that I think the public are yearning for change. They feel that the last Conservative government failed to deliver on some of the most important issues facing the country. We didn't bring down migration. The state is not working. Taxes are too high. Many public services like the NHS, for example, have been treated like a religion rather than a public service to be reformed. There are many failings. And then that Conservative government, which was removed, has been replaced by one which seems even more inept than what came before. And that is what is pushing people to reform. That is what's breeding this deep sense of disenchantment in the country, and I see no route out for that. And the biggest issue of all to me is, where is the growth going to come from in this country? And Kate's right to say that politicians, you know, Liz Truss, whoever it is, everybody says growth is, we're going to get the economy growing again. But we do know some ways to get the economy growing again, don't we? I think all power to Angela Rayner if she can build more homes and reform the planning system. I support her in that endeavour. You know, I think we've got to have a different energy policy as a country. And no government can seriously say that they care about economic growth and yet have Ed Miliband as our energy secretary. You know. You can't have You can't have a prime minister stand up in the House of Commons yesterday, you know, sort of cosplaying Winston Churchill, saying that the country is on a war footing, and then the next morning we wake up to the Committee on Climate Change saying they're going to ban lawnmowers and, you know, destroy what remains of our industrial base. Let's get serious. Have a proper energy policy. Build homes. Try and get the economy moving again. I hope that Labour managed to do those things, because I don't want to see the country stagnate for another 4 or 5 years. And I think that will be immensely harmful, frankly, to both major political parties. We've got a yearning for change. But if Labour aren't capable of doing it, then it obviously falls to my party and the new leadership that we're under to come up with a proper plan.
We're going to come to audience questions in about 5 minutes, so please start thinking if you have not already. Just picking up, though, on something you said there, Robert, I mean, you're talking about how the country wants change. You see in the steep fall in its popularity that the Labour government had that many do not think that change is coming from number 10. Yet, you mentioned reform. Do you think the Tories are doing enough of a good job at the moment of trying to establishing the idea that they could be the driving force, or are you being pushed really to the side? And before we came in the green room, we did discuss, there is a poll out tonight which has the Tories ahead by 1 point, but it's an outlier. And actually, it's more common at the moment to see polls with Reform, Labour, and then the Tories, and the Conservatives in third place.
Well, look, I said just after the general election, I think it's still true today, that Reform is a symptom, not a cause. It exists because we failed. We made big promises to the British public, and we didn't deliver them. And of course, the most prominent of those was immigration, where we said we were going to bring it down. In fact, we contrived an immigration system that was even more liberal than the one we had within the European Union. I think the points-based system that was created after the 2019 general election was amongst the worst public policy mistakes of the 21st century. And we have to atone for those errors. And it's not going to be quick. I don't think the public are going to rush back to us. I think this is going to be a long haul. We have to be honest about the mistakes we made. Kemi has certainly begun to do that. And then we've got to slowly regain trust and credibility on those issues. And look, Reform are raising issues that many people in this country care about. Crime, net zero, migration, pride in our country. And people are flocking to their banner as a result of that. But I don't think that, you know, that we should have talk of pacts. Neither party wants that. Both leaders have said it's not going to happen. Nigel Farage has said he wants to destroy the Conservative Party, and it's not in either party's electoral interest to do that. The Conservative Party has to re-establish itself as a credible party that has serious solutions to those issues and show that we have actually learnt our lessons. And that is my mission. I think that's what Kemi wants to do as well. That's what we're working to achieve.
Now, you're very active, both in your shadow brief, in your social media profile, so active that you now top the Conservative Home shadow cab league table.
I would say, when I was trying to build houses, I was bottom of the Conservative Home league table. So I've seen triumph and disaster and treat them as the imposters that they are.
That's why we are where we are.
You're obviously a very busy member of the Shadow Cabinet. One of the increasing criticisms you hear about Kemi Badenoch from some anonymous Tory MPs, from some more vocal activists, is the idea that she might just be a little bit lazy. She doesn't do enough. What do you say to that?
I don't think that's fair at all. Look, I think that...
Do you think her working hard?
I think Kemi's doing a very good job, actually. I think it's a very hard job being leader of the opposition. Ask that to William Hague, anyone who's held those jobs in the past. The problem is not Kemi Badenoch's leadership. The problem is the public's view of the Conservative Party after 14 years in office. And the brand of the Conservative Party is at the lowest ebb that I've known it in my lifetime. That is what we've got to try to turn around. I do think that opposition, I've only been doing this for 9 months now, and you know, Jonathan had to do it for a long period of time. My philosophy is that it's about hustling, isn't it? You've got to be kind of an entrepreneur. You've got to wake up every day and think, how are we going to prosecute an argument? How are we going to hold Labour to account? How can we be the strongest possible opposition? And that is a mindset that we're all learning, and that everybody in the shadow cabinet, in the parliamentary party, has to get. But, you know, I'm confident that we will get there. But as I said earlier, I think it is a long path. You know, such is the level of anger and frustration with the Conservative Party on some of those issues, it's not going to be quick to turn this around.
Kate, are we being a bit harsh on Kemi Badenoch?
Are we being a bit harsh? I never think you can be too harsh on politicians as long as we're operating within the law, right? We're not advocating anyone to be too unkind to anybody, but I think it's legitimate to be harsh on politicians. I think Kemi Badenoch has made a semi-smart decision to not rush public policy, but I also think that the days and weeks and years tick down very quickly. I think Labour's learned this in the hardest way, sorry, Jonathan. That first budget is going to set the tone of the entire parliament. And as Michael was saying, he did the really tough stuff on education. He made the cuts, he made the changes quickly. So by the time you get to the end of the parliament, you can see the success. Labour decided to present its first budget as we're going to give an inflation-busting pay raise to public sector unions and we're going to hike tax. And don't worry, guys, the growth will come after. Shockingly, that didn't work. But then, apologies to Robert and the Tory party, what was the comeback? What was the serious comeback? Yes, taxes are too high. What is the alternative? What is the very serious alternative to tackle the national debt, to tackle the deficit, to deal with every horrible public policy disaster, frankly, that has come out of COVID? You can argue it was necessary, you can argue it wasn't, but we have so much from education to crime to housing to deal with. And I don't think any of those answers are being put on the table by either party. And I know the Tories have made a choice not to, but it already does feel like we're well into this parliament. The honeymoon ended a long time ago. And the Tories are going to have to offer more, I think, at a much faster pace.
Now, just before we go to questions, Michael, we potentially have a by-election coming up. This week we had Mike Amesbury, the former Labour MP, once a stormtrooper, then suspended after he was filmed assaulting someone. And he has received 10 weeks. He's yet to resign, even though Reform have sent a van up to the constituency, urging everyone to resign and if not to sign a petition. How important do you think this by-election is going to be? Because it's really a very safe Labour seat, but Reform think they have a chance. The Tories aren't really in the fight, but yet they're not going to... Well, they're being asked to stand aside as the beginning of a Tory Reform pact, but that seems unlikely.
Yeah, I think that Labour will probably hold this seat, not because the government is vastly popular, but just because of some very specific factors. So, of course, people don't like being asked to vote in by-elections because their MP or ex-MP has done something foolish or stupid. So there won't be any sort of residual affection for Mike Amesbury, but this seat has been more or less Labour forever. And it's also the case that in electoral terms, there's a sort of an area in Cheshire and around Liverpool that was never really part of the Red Wall. So when seats elsewhere fell to the Tories or had a big Brexit vote in them, they tended to be in the mill towns of East Lancashire or on the East Coast, but not in that sort of extended greater Mersey-influenced area. So I actually think that this is a less propitious ground for Reform than some other areas might be. But one doesn't know. The comparison I think that is of interest is way back in 1981 when there was a by-election in Warrington, which is also in a similar part of the country. Roy Jenkins was the candidate for the SDP. And he was supposed to make what he called a big wakeful there. It didn't happen. He lost. But nevertheless, for the rest of that parliament, the Liberal SDP alliance won scores of by-elections, divided the left vote, and ushered in a landslide for Margaret Thatcher in 1983. So I think that even if Reform don't win, there's still going to be a feature and a factor for some time to come. But as I say, I wouldn't overstate the significance of this single by-election.
And one cheeky last question from me to Jonathan, which is, Labour are yet to pick a candidate for the by-election. Of course, you are missed in Parliament these days. And I did some Googling before I got here, and it turns out you're born in Salford, which is about a 40-minute drive from the sea. So I don't think you'd even be a carpetbagger.
Well, I mean, I was rather hoping I'd be the next political editor of The Spectator, actually.
Join the queue.
Look, I think there's more chance of Lord Lucan riding Shergar down Runcorn High Street than me being the candidate. I've been a by-election candidate before, and I'm not expecting to be a by-election candidate again. But look, Nigel Farage, they start off as the bookies' favourites for this seat. If there is a by-election, I presume there will be one. I understand the MP hasn't... I mean, the MP should resign, by the way, but I think he's appealing his conviction, I presume. But I mean, there will be a by-election sooner or later, I guess. But the Reform do start as the bookies' favourites, and they are going to throw everything at it. So it is going to be an interesting test of whether their big talk actually, when it hits the road, whether they can actually deliver. Previous by-elections, admittedly, when it was a Tory government, towards the end of the Tory government, and they talked big, they didn't get anywhere, but it's going to be very, very interesting. That's certainly true.
Okay, let's get some questions. We're going to do two at a time.
Can I? Yeah?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Brilliant.
And we can keep the questions fairly short, and if they could all be questions, that would make my life fantastic.
Question for anyone, or perhaps one of our current or former Conservative MPs. I don't want to hit any soft spots, but at the Conservative leadership election, James Cleverly talked about perhaps the Conservative Party becoming a bit more normal, he said. And I was wondering, the run-up, especially to distinguish the Tory Party from Reform and not get swallowed up, do you see any merit in normalising the Tory Party? And if so, or if not, how would you like to see the Tory Party pivot ideologically before the next election?
Okay, so your question on being normal. And let's take one more question, please.
Thank you, Michael and Robert. The part has gone played in helping Ukraine and really saying your president for Europe's support. Do you think UK will find itself in a difficult position now to either ally itself with Europe, who will be approaching, we need to do this for that, America, or do you think we'll try to build that stronger relationship with America? And maybe perhaps ask themselves a question whether they want to align themselves with someone who voted alongside Russia and North Korea recent UN resolution. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So UK aligning UK and Russia, Europe, and then of course Tories being normal. I think for the normal question, it's going to have to be Michael or Rob who wants to take that.
Well, I am not normal. I'm very abnormal. Successful Conservative leaders in the past have included some very abnormal people. Neither Margaret Thatcher nor Ted Heath, I think, would necessarily have passed the someone you would have wanted to have had a pint in the pub with test. I think that with Ted you would have had a frosty ignoral, and with Margaret Thatcher you'd have been lectured on how much more that pint of beer cost under a Labour government than under a Conservative government. So my broader point is that of course, politics, it's a cliché, has become more presidential in the way in which it's perceived, but I think, actually, ideas matter more. And it may be an old-fashioned view, and it may be an idealistic view, but I think that people choose their prime minister not necessarily on the basis of the warmth and approachability of their personality, but the clarity of their thinking and the quality of the prescription that they offer for the country. So, in that sense, you choose a spouse, you choose your friends on the basis of likability and normality. But you also, when you're choosing a political leader, you're choosing someone to do, a prime minister in particular, a specific job. So that would be my take.
Great. Mm-hmm. Who wants to take the Ukraine question?
Well, can I just make a comment on the Tory party? Because at the we at Labour Together, this think tank that I'm now involved in, we're both a think tank and basically a polling organisation. We do a lot of polling and focus groups with a view to helping the Labour government think about its policy agenda. So there is a political stance, a political reason why we're doing polling. But it's certainly true, and if I will be frank with you, and I hope the audience isn't too upset with me when I point this out, our polling, our focus groups, I think it'd be fair to say that Kemi Badenoch, she is sinking without trace in our focus groups. She really is. And I think it comes to this point that Robert made.
about hunger. I mean, I, you know, spent 14 years as in opposition, and a good 6 or 7 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, I can't quite remember, but a long time in the opposition front bench. You do have to wake up every morning working out how you are going to take the fight to the government. And I think, in fairness to Robert, you are taking the fight to my government day in, day out, actually. And when you're in opposition, all you have is the power of your words and the extent to which you can use your words, your speeches, your media interviews, your social media to capture attention and find an argument that strikes a chord with the voters that you are trying to persuade. And it is hard. Sometimes people think opposition is just throwing stones at the government and hoping eventually one of the stones will smash a window. Well, now and again, you will smash a window. But that's not really what the voters are looking for. They're looking to see whether you can make and run with a bigger argument. And it is difficult. It's frustrating. There'll be knockbacks because you're not the most interesting politician in the land. Government ministers, by the charisma of their incumbency, because they're government ministers, and the fact that they can pull levers and do things as government ministers, are much more interesting. And I think the problem that Kemi Badenoch is finding is that it doesn't feel like she wakes up every morning with that hunger. So my sort of advice, and I ought not to be giving advice to my Tory opponents or the people, because I want my Labour government to succeed, but my advice to the Tory party and the Tory front bench is all find the same hunger that Robert is displaying day after day.
Can I just come in on the question of weirdness? Because Michael once accused me of being a Tory boy in the summer.
Oh, yeah.
I was thinking as one myself.
It was during the leadership campaign. Yeah, do you think it impacted the result?
It definitely helped, Robert.
Well, Michael was the big endorsement that I was looking for, but I didn't quite get it. The one thing I was going to say was to endorse what Michael said is that it feels to me as if British politics right now, there's a sort of hollowness to it, really. There aren't big figures at the moment in British politics. You know, we have a Prime Minister who is not a charismatic person, doesn't really have a great vision. As I said earlier, I think the policies that he's bringing forward seem now to be more being handed to him by Morgan McSweeney than things that he believes in his heart. And there aren't really big solutions to the problems facing the country. It feels to me as if we're in a sort of interregnum. One period has ended, a series of big challenges face the country, and we're waiting for people to step up, bring forward serious solutions, whether it is on migration, the economy, net zero, the public services, the size of the state, defense, you name it. And so in that sense, I'm not sure, though obviously people want to have likable personalities leading the country, I feel the state of the country is so serious now that actually what people really are crying out for are people who appear to get that and have serious answers to those challenges. And if we were, as a Conservative Party, to be lucky enough to get back into government again, say after the next general election, and didn't deliver, I just think the public would be so aghast, it would be immensely corrosive to public trust. And so we have to have really, really well thought through, serious and credible solutions. Because that, I think, is what the public are crying out for right now.
Just briefly on the very good question about Ukraine. It's fiendishly difficult for any British government, whether it was led by the Conservatives or Labour, to find its way through at the moment. But I would just say two things. As acknowledged by both Robert and by Jonathan, the UK will has had to, rearm. And one part of that is both reassuring the United States that we're going to take increased responsibility for defence of our neighbours in our own backyard. And also part of that is going to have to be learning from the change on the battlefield that we've seen in the Ukraine war that has upended a number of assumptions about how future conflicts will be fought. My hunch is that whether you consider the deal that Donald Trump is offering the Ukrainian people to be shabby and transactional, and I do, but whatever you think of it, it will probably result in the conflict freezing And that, I think, is an opportunity for us to learn from Ukraine, but also to play our part in ensuring that the men, the material, and the support is there in order to make a further incursion by Putin unthinkable because the cost would be too high.
Absolutely. Kate, do you want to? Well, and then I'll get one more round of questions.
I suppose I would just say the extent to which the Prime Minister is torn between Europe and America really does indeed depend on how long the war goes on for. And I also wouldn't make the assumption that Europe will necessarily be on the same page if America does pull its funding, pull its support for Ukraine. Is Europe ready to come together and find the funds to fill that gap? Can they do that? Is Keir Starmer, he says he's willing to put boots on the ground for peacekeeping efforts, is Europe willing and ready to do that for war efforts? I don't think Europe is going to be as united on that front as perhaps it seems now. And that's why I think that it is quite right, and in some ways, let's be very honest, easier at the moment for Europe to lambast Donald Trump, as they should, about the language he uses around Ukraine and Zelensky. But the idea that America might get a freeze or indeed an end to the war would be incredibly beneficial, not just for American taxpayers and not just for the young and older men dying on the front lines in Ukraine, but for Europe as well, which is not actually really ready or able to step up to the plate were America to truly withdraw its support.
I'm just going to take two more questions, because otherwise we're going to run out of time. So let me, and I can see your hands now, so that's great. I was told by Frank Luntz once, never take questions from those sat at the front. The sides are by the doors, so let's go to the man at the front. If we can get a microphone over here.
Thank you very much. I've very much enjoyed this evening. Thank you. Like Michael Gove, I am a very proud Aberdonian working in the city of London, and I was interested today to read about BP going back to oil, I think was the strapline across the BBC. But of course, reading into that, BP, I doubt very much will be doing any drilling whatsoever in our own North Sea because of it's too expensive, because of the taxes. Just a quick question, really. How worried are you about the North Sea and Aberdeen, Michael Gove?
Okay, North Sea and Aberdeen. And that's a Michael Gove-specific question that others can join in. And then let's get our next question.
Yes, hopefully, Kate, we'll see you back soon. But also, I think it's important how we spend our money, because nobody's really raised it, and I hope Jonathan passes this through, in terms of the wastage in capital and revenue programs. That will give us the money. But also on the military, we have a lack of experienced personnel, and also in some of our industries as well. And this is the problem. We're not even doing some of our basics, whether it's in the Royal Navy, British Army, or the Royal Air Force, and we're way behind some of our European neighbours. And I think that needs to be considered. Thank you.
Right, and I'm going to drive our lovely events team mad and take one more question, because I think this way we can fit a few more in. So to make it easy, let's go for... I think there's a hand up just there.
Given that the Transatlantic Alliance is falling apart and the US is looking like we can't trust it for our defence, and it's looking like we're going to have to rely on Europe pulling together for our defence, do you, the members of the panel, regret Brexit?
Oh, okay, spicy. I like it. Is that Michael Gove specific or no?
Sounds like it.
Michael, why don't you start?
Okay, so apologies, John. Some things the Labour government is doing I think are great, but one of the worst things they're doing is their policy on energy. Rob Jenrick made that point earlier. I'd like to consider myself as green. I do think that we do need to move away over time from hydrocarbons, but we're doing it far too fast. It means that the hydrocarbons that our economy needs will continue to be supplied, but be supplied in a way which means that we put more power in the hands of Putin and the Saudis. It means that our carbon emissions, or global carbon emissions, are greater than they would otherwise be, and it also means that we continue to have higher energy costs. Our energy costs are four times those of America, and that will contribute to deindustrialization overall. So it's not just a tragedy for Aberdeen, it undermines global security, it doesn't contribute to the war against climate change, and it also means that the economic base that our country must rely on, the industrial base our country must rely on in order to power growth in the future, is being eroded faster than at any time in our history. So it's a tragedy. And Ed Miliband is a gifted and talented person, but he's using all his gifts and all his talents to drive this country into the ground. Then, on Brexit, no, I don't, because... one of the problems with the EU's hitherto established position on defence and security is that every spare pound that you give to Europe for its common security and foreign policy architecture, it goes on conferences, communiques, junkets, and more four and five star generals based in attractive chateau outside Brussels. It doesn't actually go on kit and increasing firepower. And if you look at the countries of Europe, there are basically the Joint Expeditionary Force, Britain, the Baltics, the Nordics, and the Dutch, who have truly professional militaries that are capable of rising to the challenge of modern warfare. Some of those countries, notably, of course, Norway, are not in the European Union, but they're among our most professionally militarily deployable allies. The other, of course, big country is France, which has the capacity to project force abroad. But France is never going to surrender control of its armed forces to a pan-European or multilateral organization. So, you know, in that sense, if it's a choice between the approach of General de Gaulle or the approach of Guy Verhofstadt, I think that General de Gaulle and an approach based on national sovereignty, a recognition that people fight and die for their family and their country, not for abstract ideals, I think that is a better way of thinking about defence in the future.
We've got 5 minutes, so we're going to go Robert, Jonathan, I'm going to give Kate the last word. And you didn't get to ask a question. Just grab people so they can't leave as they exit the stage and have a one-on-one exclusive. Okay, Robert.
Well, firstly, I don't think we should write off the transatlantic relationship. Let's wait and see what actually happens. I think Donald Trump is a much more complicated person than some parts of the media would like to think. In his first administration, he left more troops in Europe than there were when he arrived. He actually funded Ukraine. Let's see what this minerals agreement that he's about to sign actually contains. It sounds like it may contain a security guarantee for Ukraine. Some of the things that have been debated are actually in a long line of US history, asking for something in return for giving protection. I mean, the Monroe Doctrine, the loans that the US gave to us during the Second World War, tariff reform that they forced on us during the First World War. You know, there's a long history here. So let's actually wait and see. I actually think that in terms of Brexit, on an issue I've obviously given a lot of thought to in recent years, migration, the decision to leave the European Union will turn out to be one of the most important that we've made in our modern history. Because I think mass migration, as we're now discovering, will be the defining generational challenge in pretty much every Western country. And the ability to secure your borders as much as any country can, I think, is a huge prize. We haven't used that correctly. We have misused it, pulled the levers in entirely the wrong directions. But I think the fact that we have control of those levers is something that future generations will thank us for. And I think Michael did a great job in that respect and will be thanked in the future when the UK is able to control its borders like no other country in Europe and few other countries in the world. To your point, sir, about the North Sea oil and gas, I think it's a terrible situation. It's one of the biggest failings of this government. As Michael said, you know, Ed Miliband is a dangerous man because he knows what he wants to do. It's just what he wants to do is a disaster for this country. And the decision to move away from oil and gas is going to compromise hundreds of thousands of jobs, billions of pounds in tax revenues. And it's just not serious. It's not serious when you're saying that we're facing Vladimir Putin, these challenges for our national security. We've got to have energy security. We've got to have Treasury having the revenue that's needed to fund defense and public services. And we've got to have a fundamentally different policy. I also blame my own government for that, because I think net zero was net zero 2050 was the ultimate example of poor decision making. You know, a debate that lasted 90 minutes, no vote on it. Philip Hammond, I was a junior minister in the Treasury at the time. Philip was in a war with Michael over some of his green policies. And Philip once turned to me and said that we debated banning plastic straws more than we did the biggest change to our economy since the Industrial Revolution. And that was true. So we've got to grow up, have a more serious policy. And that means, yes, decarbonize, but do so in a sensible and pragmatic way which defends our industrial base such that it is and ensures that we have national security as well.
So I voted for Remain in that referendum, and I don't regret the way I cast my ballot in that referendum. I just want to mention one thing. I'm not going to attempt to rebut Robert or Michael on the various points where they've given us their opinion of the state of my Labour government, because I don't think I'm not playing at home tonight, am I? So I don't think there's much point. So I just want to make a slightly different adjacent point. Just Robert touched upon this, and I just want to mention this very briefly in conclusion, because I think this issue is going to shoot up the political agenda over the next 12, 18 months. And it is this issue around critical minerals. Nobody's really given much attention to the critical minerals deal with Ukraine. We're obviously more focused on the future security of Europe for very, very understandable reasons. But I think increasingly access to critical minerals is going to become a hot political issue. Frankly, we are too reliant at the moment on China for absolutely vital critical minerals, which are integral not only to whether we become an AI superpower, but integral to whether we can spend that defence increase sensibly on the type of modern equipment that will keep us safe. At the moment, too much of the West is completely dependent on China and other countries that we don't want to be dependent on. So that means we've got to think about how we stockpile lithium and tin. We've got to think about the deals that we can do with other countries around the world. There are other countries on the globe who produce these critical minerals. We've just become too lazy and allowed China to dominate the world market on this. So I think it's going to be very interesting what deal is signed with Ukraine on this. But I suspect, and my hunch is, over the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to be talking about this a hell of a lot more in British politics as well. And we've got to get a strategy in place in this country about how we can access critical minerals in a sensible way, because it is actually vital to our own security as a nation. Very right.
And Kate, with that, your last Coffee House Shots Live, last word.
I'm getting emotional. On Brexit, I was a young immigrant American when Michael Gove was staging the referendum. I did not dare have an opinion when it was going on. It wouldn't have been appropriate. I didn't have a vote. So I listened. And I've been watching very closely as a journalist over the years. And I'll say this. It's difficult to name so far too many benefits of Brexit. But the benefits I can name are very impressive. The vaccine rollout, people say you could have gone your own way if you had been in the European Union, but Europe didn't go its own way. The UK was able to be nimble and quick and save countless lives. And the other major example is Ukraine. The UK was able to come out with its own voice, stronger and faster than any other country in the world, to defend Zelensky and the Ukrainian people who were standing up to an aggressor. And it was able to create its own scheme for Ukrainian refugees to come to the UK, and there was never a people and never a country kinder or more accepting than those refugees who came to seek peace. And since you've given me the last word, that's very kind, Katie, I'm not going to be unfair, because if I start talking too much about immigration, Robert will want to respond. And we've already had our big immigration debate at party conference a couple years ago, but I will just say this.
I thought you were a reformed character now.
Reformed character, Robert, I'm doubling down on the benefits of migration. We'll do this another time, but I will just say this, thinking about the way that the UK responded. to Ukraine. There is a reason that immigration figures have been so elevated the past couple of years. And I would just say this, a nation has to do what's right for the nation. You know, I'm not going full out Britain first, but a nation has to think about what's right for the UK. Never take for granted the fact that people want to come here. I wanted to come here. There aren't that many countries that you can truly name. America and the UK, they might be having their differences right now, but they sit in this very small pool of countries where people from all over the world are desperate to come here and desperate to be British. And I would just say, do what you need to do, do what's right for the UK, but never take that for granted. It is a wonderful thing to say about the UK that people want to be British.
Thank you.